I'm, like we said, Wojtek. I'll be presenting my research, which is mostly on causal analysis in neuroimaging. And the general layout of my talk is going to just briefly discuss causality in neuroscience, what we mean by that in terms of neural systems. And then to contrast that causality in time series analysis, how it's different, what we're trying to learn about neural systems when we apply time series analysis techniques to neural data. So transferable concepts between the two, between time series analysis and neuroscience, applications to MEG, and just various considerations that one might have when they're applying any kind of causal analysis to data. So to start off, we all know essentially what we're dealing with when we're discussing causality in neuroscience. Generally, what we think is happening is that a large population of neurons might be active, and this is inducing some kind of magnetic field. In general, a neuron population is active, and they're going to be sending messages to other populations of neurons that affect some kind of cause on them. And what we do usually is record the magnetic field induced by this neural activity from outside the skull. When we do this, you might imagine that in this example, there are a blue population of neurons having an effect on a green population of neurons. And if they were all to be simultaneously active, you could expect some kind of waveform to happen here. And then sometime later, you'd see the effects caused on the green population of neurons. So it's a delayed kind of waveform. And you could easily see that in this case, there's some kind of causality exerted from one to the other. And we want to be able to study this in a more formal setting. So in this case, it's a fairly clean picture of a relationship between two signals. But in general, in time series analysis and in neuroimaging, you get much messier signals that could look something like these. And I gave an example here where I produced three time series. And the blue time series is, 90% of the variance in the blue time series could be explained by one of these two other signals. And it's not immediately obvious which one that is. So causality is well hidden in time series, and you need, in some cases, sophisticated techniques to extract any kind of causal relationships. And it actually turns out, if anyone wanted to take a guess beforehand, that the green time series here explains 90% of variance of the blue time series, and it's actually any three consecutive terms here summed produce the next point in the blue time series plus noise. So in order to understand any kind of relationships between two time series, what we usually want or are looking for is some function that calculates x, or the value of some time series at time t, given some input, which is the history of one or more signals. So the signal from time 1 to t minus 1. And if you could find some equation that does this, then you might be able to infer some form of causality that it's happening. So one equation that is popularized in this type of analysis that does this is these autoregression equations. What they essentially do is produce some some value here at time t for time series I as a sum over other time series n and over lags p of other time signals. Plus some noise. So in the univariate case, it's pretty straightforward. If we were looking for, or trying to predict the green value over here based on its immediate history of the signal. So if there's some function that you could input the history of the signal into that function and get the green value, then you could make predictions about how the signal is evolving. And in the bivariate case, what you're doing is adding as predictors the history of another signal at a certain amount of lags. And if in this case you could predict the green observation here. Yeah, there was a green observation. There it is. If you could predict the green observation from the history of two signals, and including this signal in the regression, in the prediction, if it helps in predicting the first signal at the top there, then you could say that this second signal here might be exerting some causal influence on the first signal. So then when we're dealing with autoregressive models, in the sense, we want to be able to fit the coefficients here, A, for these models. And these are the free parameters that get estimated from the data. And to be able to talk about causality in terms of autoregressive models, what people often do is look to see whether any of these coefficients, the absolute value of them, are greater than zero. And if that's the case, then if the coefficient describing the relationship from times to use n to times to use I at lag p is greater than zero, then you can make some kind of claim about times to use n influencing times to use I. And another way to also think about causality in this case, I just rearranged the equation up here, is to look at the errors that result from any of these autoregressive models. So if you have some time series x, and you subtract the prediction for x, you get the error here. And if you calculate the variance of the error here, and in this case you exclude one of the time series from the error predictions. So if this error variance is much less than this error variance, then you know that including time series n in the estimation actually helped in predicting time series I, so you can make some claim about time series n having an influence on time series I. And this is often summarized as Granger causality, which is shown here, which is just the log of the ratio of the variances. So if there is Granger causality, then this term here is going to be positive. If there isn't, it'll be zero or next to zero. And another thing we look at is, before I was just discussing causality in the temporal domain, but we're also interested as neuroscientists in causality in the frequency domain, because we know that rhythms are a very fundamental part of neural systems, and they contribute a lot to how interactions are organized. So we want to know whether causalities exist at different frequencies. And often, when people use autoregressive models to describe time series, what ends up happening is we look at the coefficients and to see if they have any kind of frequency composition that allows us to describe the relationship from, let's say, one population of neurons to another. And this essentially amounts to a Fourier transform of the coefficients. And we've seen Fourier transforms here a few times. Let's say you have, you were to estimate an autoregressive model that looked like this. It's just a sample 2 hertz wave. You'd want to see that there is some kind of causality at 2 hertz. So there's a non-zero value over here at 2 hertz. And we're able to calculate using this Fourier transform. And what that essentially amounts to is this function over here, where it's a little complicated to see, I guess, but if you were to basically linearly sum these coefficients, that would be the discrete Fourier transform at 0 hertz. And for subsequent frequencies, you would apply some rotation to the coefficients and sum them after the rotation. And you could see how at 0 hertz, all the coefficients cancel out. At 1 hertz, they also cancel out. And then at 2 hertz, all the coefficients unfold to give you the peak here. And hopefully that gives you some intuition into what is going on when people talk about causality in the frequency domain. It's just an unraveling of these coefficients. So those are the general concepts of causality in autoregressive models, and I've developed some way of looking at these in meta-analysis. So we started by first doing an experiment where we had subjects and they were presented a random sequence of cues. So these are a little offset here, but in one case, subjects received a visual cue, which was the right arrow or the left arrow, or this mixture of the two arrows here. And in another experiment, they received the verbal cues, which was the spoken word right, left, or free. And when they were cued with these presentations here, they had to perform the correct response, which was a right button press, a left button press, or in this case, they had to choose either a right or left button press and perform that. And this was divided up in the data set into forced and free trials here. And our analysis was to do a classification of forced and free trials. And what I used to perform this classification was this. This is the Granger causality that I was describing before, but this is a feature based on that, which I had to kind of work out because the Granger causality feature itself doesn't really lend itself well to classification analyses. But the feature over here is essentially Granger causality from I to J, assuming autoregressive coefficients from forced trials, minus Granger causality from I to J, assuming autoregressive coefficients from free trials. And the idea is that if the trial is forced, this feature should be very high. If you're allowed, or if you're capable of making a distinction of free and forced using time series I and J, and if the trial is free, then it should be negative. And that's how you're supposed to be able to classify based on that. Essentially, this isn't something that's been done regularly, so I had to perform quite a range of validation and parameter tuning to see how the analysis responded to different parameter settings. And I just, to do that, did a basic cross-validation approach where I withheld some of the data for a final validation at the end and used four folds here to adjust parameters. And the general outline of the classification method is shown here, but the important part is that I calculate the features that I was describing before for every pair of MEG sensors in the training features here. I rank the training features based on which ones are best capable of providing some kind of classification benefit. And then I train a classifier based on the highest ranked features. And then I apply that classifier to testing features. And the intuition is, especially with all the parameter tuning that I've done, is that if the classification improves from some variation of the parameter settings, then I'm capable of actually extracting some kind of information relevant to distinguishing free and forced button presses. And that's getting closer at like the neurally relevant events that are occurring that allow me to distinguish the free and forced trials. And the classifier that I used is basically just a basic naive Bayes classification where you assume that there's some kind of underlying distribution from where you're drawing your observations. And if they look like this green and blue distribution, if you're drawing your observation from here, you know that the posterior probability is actually higher for the green identity. So you say that it's coming from the green distribution. And this is just extended over the classification that I use is just this idea extended over multiple features. And what actually happens here is that this naive Bayes classification method is a little more resistant to overfitting than most other classification methods are, so that the number of features that you use to classify with could actually far exceed the number of trials that you had, and you wouldn't be performing the same overfitting that happens. Which is good, because in my case, I had something like 20,000 pairs of sensors and usually something like 200 trials to work with. So some of the parameter settings that I did play around with were the number of features that I used to classify with. And the number over here is just the log base 2 of the number of features that I used. So I actually found that at one feature, classification was around 60%. But increasing the number of features that I used to classify improved classification, which isn't surprising. But it's not obvious how many features you actually need to perform your best classification. And I decided that I could stop at about 512 features for classification. And this is the amount that I used for all subsequent analysis. Another topic that people find interesting, I guess, in these types of studies is what is a suitable autoregressive model order? And what is a suitable downsampling factor that you would use for preprocessing the data? And it's not always obvious which one is best, and there's plenty of people arguing one side or the other. But what I actually found was that performing this classification to see where the highest classification occurred was actually a good method for validating some of the other assumptions that people might be making. And over here, you can see there's a patch or like a range of autoregressive model orders and downsampling factors where classification could be achieved to a high degree. And this occurs for model orders as high as 8 and downsampling factors for as low as 6 or as high as 14. And in most cases, this amounted to an extension of the autoregressive model to about 100, 150 milliseconds into the history of the signal, which is reasonable for neural events happening. Yep. Oh, yeah, these are classification rates at different combinations of autoregressive model orders and downsampling factors. Oh, here and here. Yeah, it's definitely not huge, but there is some effects that you can get by kind of playing around with these parameters. And it's definitely significant to the point that like you would want to find the best combination of parameter settings. But yeah, it's actually kind of surprising the range that you do get. And our original signal that was sampled at 625 hertz could be downsampled something like 10 or 11 fold down to about 60 hertz, and you could still retain a lot of the classification power from the analysis. So it's interesting to know, and this does kind of give you a feel to play around with if you were to do like a spectral analysis of causality. You might want to pick an AR model order that's a bit longer, because that would give you better resolution in the frequency domain. But if you just want to get a quick algorithm that works and has like a high degree of classification, you might just pick a low model order. I guess there's always an interest of where in time a neural event is happening. So in our case, we had an experiment where the subject was presented a cue, and the subject was expected to respond to that cue by pressing a button. So there's various windows in time there where the relevant neural events could have been happening that allowed us to classify whether or not the button press was free or forced. So over here, I just varied that window And in this box over here, for instance, this was at 0 milliseconds after the key was presented until the average reaction time over here. And then this box, for instance, is going to be 50 milliseconds after the key was presented until the very end. And you could see that you do get quite a bit high accuracy classification here, but if you're looking for the most narrowed down window where neural events relevant to button pressing are occurring, you'd probably want to pick one of these regions over here. There's also the topic of artifact deletion, which is always a problem when you're working with Meg. And I actually, this is a rather crude approach to handling artifact deletion, but I thought it would be interesting to look at nonetheless, and it gave, I think, fairly interesting results, and I think it's a little bit revealing about what this classification analysis actually pulls out of the data and what information you're using from Meg data to successfully classify trials. And what I ended up doing was calculating the principal components of the Meg data, projecting the principal components into the principal component space, then the variable that I manipulated over here was the number of the highest variance principal components that I deleted. And the idea is that artifacts like blinking or eye movements are among the highest variance components of a signal. And when I actually ended up, when I did look at the data, then usually in the first 10 or so principal components, four of them had some kind of visible deflection that was related to the eye movement. I performed that analysis, and it was actually kind of a bit surprising that you could delete up to 12 or 13 principal components before reaching the highest classification accuracy, because you'd expect that a majority of the signal would be gone by that time. But it turns out that you don't totally deteriorate the neural components of the signal until you reach about 70 principal component deletion. And just to show that there is something left in the signal at 13 principal components deleted, I gave an example of two signals over here where this one has a blink artifact, and the blue signal over here is what that exact signal looks like after I've deleted 13 principal components. And these two signals are just one Meg signal that doesn't have a blink artifact. And the blue one is the same signal after the principal component deletion. So you see that although the signal gets deteriorated a little bit with this artifact deletion procedure, it still it retains a lot of the original signal itself. And it's not unreasonable to expect that you might be able to classify based on that. Another interesting thing I thought to look at was where in space the sensor pairs are relative to each other. And so the two things that I did over here was to pre-specify some kind of minimum sensor separation distance. And so let's say at 5 centimeters over here, I only used sensor pairs that were above 5 centimeters from each other and performed the classification based on that. So you could see that as you increase the minimum sensor separation distance, your ability to classify falls. Over here, the maximum sensor separation distance, you get a similar kind of effect, where if you're only using the most local sensor pairs, you get good enough classification, but it improves when you're also incorporating sensor pairs that are far away from each other. So after I had done that, settled on a bunch of parameter settings that I thought were suitable for continuing my analysis, I decided to look at the features that I was actually using and kind of investigate where in the sensor space the relationships were coming from that were allowing me to classify these trials. So in the case of the visually cued experiment, I'll explain how these images work a bit. But to start, I looked at the output from all of the sensors to, let's say, the sensor over here and a hot color over here would indicate that there is a large difference from the output of all of these sensors to here in free and forest trials. And in the case of the input from this sensor to all of the black sensors would be very different over here for free and forced trials. So I did this because you could sort of spatially segregate the sensors a little bit more and learn in a little bit more detail where the relationships are. And in the case of the visually cued experiment, the most interesting effects that we saw were in parietal and occipital regions. So right here you could see that the output from the dark sensors over here to the sensors in the parietal lobe is most different for reinforced button presses. And this is kind of the inverse of that. So the input to parietal sensors is most different from occipital lobes. So that is the origin of the signals that allow us to best distinguish reinforced button presses. So the output primarily from visual cortices and input primarily to parietal cortices. Similarly, in the verbally cued experiment, we didn't get the same kind of degree of classification or degree of features showing up here. But similarly, we saw that there might be a patch over here that has some input to other regions, specifically the central regions over here. So what I did was a little bit of post hoc pulling out these sensors over here and looking at what they're related to. So it turns out that the output of these sensors over here is the best place to look if you want to classify reinforced trials. So what we can conclude about that is that the output primarily from this posterior left temporal cortex is what we're basing classification on. And this is interesting because in the two experiments, the cortices most responsible for our ability to classify were the sensory cortices responsible for perceiving the cues. So we also did a control experiment where the subjects were asked to attend to the cues without performing any kind of response. So they weren't asked to press right or left buttons, and it turned out that these effects were actually much more robust in the case where they had to generate a free or forced response rather than in the case that they weren't. So it does seem to be that the output from the sensory cortices has some kind of contribution to the generation of free and forced button presses. So as much as most people, people work in sensor space because it's convenient and easy and for a lot of other reasons, but it's not always going to give you the results that you want when you want to discuss very specific neural anatomy. So I wanted to see how well my classification procedure worked when I performed a few blind source separation techniques. So the setup of this experiment was a little bit different. At each of these sensor positions, I took a pool of other sensors. So it turned out to be the 25 nearest sensors and just performed the classification analysis on those and then repeated the analysis for all the other sensors and their 25 nearest partners. And if I were just to perform this on sensor space, then you could see you're capable of classifying. Sorry, this is for the visually cued task only. You're able to classify using these posterior occipital sensors. The sensor with artifact deletion that I described here is just what I was showing before. So this provides some kind of added benefit, the artifact deletion procedure, to classification. So you could see that this might be something that you'd want to do if you wanted to boost classification a bit, just to handle artifacts in some way. This other method that I tried was to perform, I just picked a random orthogonal matrix and performed a rotation of the data from sensor space using that matrix and got these classification accuracies, which you can see is very comparable actually to what I was able to achieve in sensor space. So not that these are random mixtures of signals, but they do depend quite a bit on the neural anatomy and the position of sensors, but in terms of classification, they perform quite similarly to if you were to randomly rotate the data and mix it. So the more successful approaches that I tried were PCA and CSP, which is common spatial patterns, which is commonly used for classification of neural signals, and ICA. So in the case of these three, they all provided an additional boost to classification. And in terms of PCA over here, was done very similarly over here to what I did over here. I just didn't project back into sensor space. And you can see that actually provides separation of the sensor data into principal components, and then performing Granger causality analysis on that does provide boosted classification results. Similar for ICA, and these were actually pretty comparable. So if you were to proceed in this kind of direction, then using either of these methods would probably be the most advisable, and then you could probably have some idea of how to kind of look into more source localization from these steps over here. So the conclusions that I wanted to make is that one of the points I was trying to make the whole time, that Granger causality is a useful concept for classification analysis. Number two is that parameter selection can cause unexpected results if not explored carefully. So you do, in any kind of typical analysis, want to explore different variations on parameters. And also have some way to validate that your decisions are actually going to benefit your analysis. And not everyone has a direct approach to doing this, but classification is one method one could try that. And once you do have some good neighborhood of parameters that you have to work with, it is fairly robust. So in the case of like an autoregressive model order, if you know that the range from 4 to 8 is good, you can be fairly comfortable in assuming that if you change it by 1 or 2, you're not going to totally change the results of your analysis. Yeah. Thank you.